Hello and welcome to New Netherland Praatjes, a series of chats on the Dutch colony of New Netherland, brought to you by the New Netherland Institute and the New Netherland Research Center in Albany, New York. Praatjes is Dutch for chat, and these are informal conversations with historians, archaeologists, and other experts on the world of the 17th century Dutch.
Hello, everyone. I am Steve Mackerlane of the New Netherland Institute, the producer of this New Netherland Praatjes podcast, and today, your host. I am here with our usual host, Russell Shorto, who is on the other side of the table today. We are here at the John Jay Homestead in Katona, New York, and I'm from Rockland County. And growing up in Rockland County, we knew that the money was in Westchester. And I can tell you that has not changed. There are a lot of stone walls in Westchester, and that is, I think, indicative of the difference between Westchester and Rockland. So anyway, Russell is the author of several books. Is this your seventh book, Russell?
Sixth
book, including Amsterdam, History of the World's Most Liberal City, and The Island at the Center of the World, The Epic Story of Dutch Manhattan. His most recent book, and the one we are going to talk about today, is Revolution Song, A Story of American Freedom. Russell, welcome.
Thank you, Steve. Great to be with you on the other side of the microphone.
Great to have you. How is the book tour going?
I did the main book tour. It was about 5 or 6 weeks, a grueling slog, as they always seem to be. It went well. It's just it's hard. It's humbling because you do the event, and the event is this nicely curated event, as I'm sure it will be tonight here at the John Jay Homestead, and it's a nice room full of people. But otherwise, you're in airports and on trains, and you just you're constantly have this feeling that the wider world is indifferent to you and your concerns and your book that you've written. But it's gone fine.
Okay. As I told you earlier, I just finished a book yesterday. It's a big book. Is this your biggest book?
Yes.
By how much?
Island probably was the biggest before this.
300 pages or so?
That was, I think, maybe 325 pages. And this, with front and back matter, it's more than 600.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
And but you think about it, it's six people's lives. And I wanted to tell the stories from birth to death. That's a lot of material. Yeah. You gotta get a lot in there because that's the way, that was my conceit from the beginning.
Well, it felt like 550.
That's the best compliment I've ever received.
Well, here's a better one. what I was most impressed by is how well it held together with all these six disparate. I mean, they came together occasionally with Corn Planter in Washington and with Margaret, what's her name, Moncrief in Washington. But generally they were parallel, but not they didn't come together. And I know we've discussed this before. It seems effortless, but as you've said, it's far from effortless to actually get this to happen the way that you want it
to
happen.
I think, and no matter what you do, you work really hard to make it look like it wasn't hard to do. That was my concern from the very beginning of even having the idea being, take a group of people from very different backgrounds and weave their stories together. I chose people, and that was the hardest thing to do, to choose people from very different backgrounds whose paths cross, because that helps me to create one narrative rather than, in this case, six different ones. But I also didn't want to force it. I didn't want to make it too, force connections that weren't there. So that was the question throughout the writing. And frankly, it's still the question in my mind. Does this work? Does it hold together as one piece?
Okay, so today I'd like to first get into the content of the book and kind of the big ideas in the book. And then from there, we'll go more into your process into writing this book and then maybe some general thoughts about your writing. So let's talk about the characters. We have George Washington, George Germain, Margaret Moncrief, Abraham Yates Jr., Corn Planter, and did I forget?
Venture Smith.
Venture Smith.
Yeah.
Just briefly, we all know who George Washington is, of course. And actually, this is an aside here, but I remember when you told me you chose George Washington, I thought it was an odd choice.
Mm-hmm. It was the last one I chose.
And it was, I enjoyed reading about him the most.
Oh, how interesting.
Because I think we all have this preconceived idea of who George Washington was. Mm-hmm. And we feel an affinity toward George Washington, most of us, I think. And it was just really interesting to actually have insights into his, well, first of all, his flaws. I mean, and it's somewhat inspiring too, because of all the mistakes that he made. It's mm-hmm. like, oh, well, he turned out all right. At least his legacy did. If that matters, I don't know if that really matters. But okay, I'm getting ahead of ourselves. So
well, it's interesting you say that because he was the last one I chose, and maybe he was so obvious that I didn't see it until later. But as soon as I did. Everything made sense because he's the one who connects most of the others. And the whole idea of someone of that renown, more or less being treated on the same plane as the others, everybody's birth, everybody's parentage, everybody's having children and having struggles and having pains.
Him dealing with his mother who...
His mother was a bit of a shrew.
Yeah.
So that was my thought then, putting them on the same, more or less on the same plane. He gets a little more space than some of the others, but that then reinforces a statement about the overall sort of equality or humanity.
I guess the Germain would be the next logical one to speak of because he's the least connected. I would say, of them all.
Well, he never meets any of the others. Yeah. Right. He was the first one, actually, who I hit on and decided, oh, I've got to do him. Because, and I think partly he is just such a, every story needs a bad guy, and he's a beautiful bad guy.
Yeah.
And he is this embodiment of the feudal empire-building mentality and of the aristocracy. And through him, it was a chance to talk about what I think Americans don't really appreciate often when they think of the American Revolution, which was that it was not the case that England was this monolithic feudal empire-building enemy. The Whigs basically were of the... their perspective was, hey, we created this thing called the Enlightenment, and now they're using it against us. So they basically were on the side of the Americans in many respects. And through Germain, you see him fighting with Whig leaders in Parliament. And come to appreciate something of the complexity that was going on within England at the time.
Venture Smith,
I didn't have definite slots. I want to have this person from this walk of life and this and one person from another walk of life. But except I needed, of course, to have someone who was a slave, at least for part of his life. There's a category called slave narratives. And so my original thought was, well, I'll just go through them and pick out the best one. You run into a problem, which is that there's a sameness to them. It turns out that they were generated by abolitionists for this purpose to advance their cause. And they kind of process them. There's this Christian moralizing tone and it becomes hard to feel the subject. Venture Smith stands out. He happened to have dictated his life story when he was an old man. And it jumps right out at you. The voice does, and he never learned to read and write, but he, I think, clearly wanted it read back to him and wanted to, and resisted making changes to it. And it's a remarkable life. And a third of his narrative takes place in Africa. So you get a sense of that, his life there. You get the whole passage.
And he was how old when he?
About 10.
10, okay.
Yeah. He watches his father be murdered, and because he won't give up the secret of where his money is buried, and this is a motif in Venture's life. Money is everything to him. Money is the way you count. Money is the way you determine what matters. After his daughter is sick, and he's recounting this story, he doesn't say, "Thank God she got better." He says, "The doctors cost me 40 pounds, So he reckons everything in dollars or pounds. But he, Venture, what appealed to me as well, I mean, not only does he become a slave, He frees himself and his family. He buys them out of slavery, yeah. And he does it. He's working and saving money through the 1760s into the 1770s while white Americans are clamoring about freedom. So he is implicitly assuming that this freedom is not going to apply to him. He's got to take matters into his own hands. So he's kind of carrying out his own American Revolution on the side.
Yeah, and that quote I was looking for is when, I believe it was after, he was sold off when shortly after his first child was born. And this kind of hardened this idea that things come down to monetary transactions. Mm-hmm. And as you said, his realization was that affection, love, consideration were soft and uncertain and not to be counted on.
Yeah, I mean, for him, money mattered, and he would bury his savings, and he would, you know, he took great care. He knew every penny that he had.
Margaret Moncrief.
She, you know, the one, I guess one regret I have, other than the fact that I used the adjective small in referring to John Jay, I should have used slight, not small, because in fact he was 6 feet two. But the one regret I have is I wanted to have at least two women in the book, and then it was kind of between Yeats and I had Molly Brandt in mind and a couple of others, and Yeats, because of his anti-federalist stance, I just felt like I have to put him in there, and seven characters is too many. I ended up with Margaret Moncrief because she is such a character. She is such a force of nature, but also because, you know, in a sense, the book is about freedom, in not just in the narrow sense that we usually think of when we think of the American Revolution, but in this much broader sense that comes out of the Dutch Enlightenment in the 1600s. And, you know, starting in the 1620s and 30s and by the mid-1700s was this great wave that was rolling across Europe and in America. And slavery, the notion that slavery was immoral was part of it. What rights ought women to have in society was part of it. And where that came down in the 1770s was the issue of forced marriage, the idea that a woman shouldn't be forced to marry against her will. And that was her story. She was forced, right in the middle of the revolution, her father, who was a British officer, forced her to marry another British officer whom she despised, and apparently for good reason. And she tried to resist and couldn't, and her life ends up being this tragedy. It's like a series of highs and lows, but ultimately a tragedy, which comes back to, I think you could say, being too much ahead of your time. You know, the world wasn't ready for the kind of independence that she was craving.
Didn't you say that it was believed that she died before she actually did?
There are not many people who have written about her and researched her, but those who have concluded that she died in 1787, in June of 1787, for the very good reason that there are obituaries.
Her death notices.
In London newspapers then. The problem I had with that was her memoir comes out in 1794, and the events in it go right up to 1794. So, you know, if you just think about that logically for a second, she's naming names. She's writing about events, interactions with real people right up to 1794. Now, practically speaking, if this happened in your life and you had interactions with this person who had died 7 years ago, and here's this book that comes out and said that you just had dinner with them last month, you'd say, wait a second. So it just didn't make sense to me. But I had to find, you know, a smoking gun or something to you know. So I did a lot of digging, and my first strike was at the New York Historical Society. I found a letter that she wrote asking for money in 1803. Then I found another letter in 1805, and then one from 1796. So indeed, she lived on. So, and then going back into the memoir, she almost says it on the page. She apparently, she had built up this mountain of debt, and she faked her own death and then fled to Paris. And that too is part of a pattern. She runs several times. She makes these dramatic exits, one being when she runs away from her abusive husband, and that's in an inn in Wales. She just walks out the back door of the inn and into the mountains and hikes 60 miles across the mountains and never sees him again.
And she ends up on the arm of many prominent men.
Yeah, that was her. I think that from our perspective, you could say that she wanted a life of independence. And for a woman to achieve that, you had to be a mistress or an actress. And she basically tried both and had more success being a mistress. And so there she is at balls in London or in Paris with aristocrats. And then a few months later, she's in debtor's prison. So that was kind of the tone of her life.
And they put her right in debtor's prison with her young child.
Yeah, that's right? they were.
And she had a child in debtor's prison as well.
That's right. Yeah. And so as her story goes on and kind of moves progressively downward, she's adding children, and then some of them are being taken away from her.
Her two sons were taken away by the one.
By one of her men.
Yeah. Corn planter.
The hardest part about writing about Native Americans from the period, I think, is trying to get to them, a close sense of them, because they, for the most part, did not write the records. So you're getting it from the perspective of the French or the Americans or the British. Corn planter, there are a variety of sources, and sources that give you not just his public deeds, which were quite considerable, but that give you a little bit of an idea of who he was and what he was like. And that's what I really try to do is, you know, writing narrative history. I try to get into the, under the skin of the people. One thing in particular, one source in particular, his nephew, who was called Governor Blacksnake, who was younger than him and kind of trooped around with him everywhere he went, then when he was an old man, he dictated his memoirs to an Iroquois who took it down in kind of pidgin English. And in his memoir is a lot of detail about corn planter's life. So that is a much closer, it feels closer. And plus you can kind of triangulate, you can put that together with sources from Americans or British and get it. So that gives you a little bit closer sense of him. And he was just a remarkable figure. And I think the fact that his mother was Seneca and his father was a white man from upstate New York.
Fort Plain, the hometown of Charles Garing.
That's right. and he has reminded me of that on numerous occasions.
I'm sure he has. Did Charlie know of him, of the character?
Yeah, he knew of his father, too, if that's
what
he
meant. Yeah,
he knew of him.
John Abel? John Abel.
A-B-E-E-L. And then Corn Planter, as he becomes more known and as like newspapers start to write about him, they refer to him as Captain O'Bail, O'Bail. They just, in some strange way, sort of Irished his name. So they'll say, you know, Captain O'Bail of the Seneca tribe is in town today, kind of thing.
Now, as I was reading, I was thinking about, did you notice right away when you saw that name, or did you come back and say, oh, that is Corn Planter they're talking about when you saw the O'Bail?
I don't know, but I'd read a lot about him, and that's a thing that people writing about him are going to point out too. And then there are various Abales who are out there now who have written me and said, oh, you know, those are my ancestors, those are my people. And somebody sent me their family tree. And, you know, so you, from various sources, you stitch things together.
Okay. All right. So those are the six characters. So who did you pass on? Who would have been number seven if you had to add number seven?
Maybe Molly Brandt. I really wanted to include Molly Brandt because she gives you this really nice, she's at the nexus of the British and the American and the Iroquois worlds. And the reason I didn't include her is we know a lot about certain periods of her life, but nothing about a lot of her life. And the conceit of the book was kind of from birth to death. So I wanted to have that. There were a couple of other women who wrote sort of farm diaries. And I liked the idea of a life that's carrying on, that we come back to periodically, that is, you know, it's continuing while all this craziness is going on. But I had kind of practical issues with that, in that someone like Venture Smith, there's a whole kind of cottage industry built around him, that people have done archaeology at the site of the house he built, and they've researched his family and so on. So I could lean on that. You know, you have, you need to work with other sources. And with these couple of people in particular, no one had done that. So it's like, okay, I have to do so much work. If I'm just going to do a biography about that one person, fine. But if it's one of five or six or seven, then I just made the practical decision that I couldn't invest that much energy.
Yeah, I mean, and as far as investing, I was thinking about this as well. I did enjoy reading about Washington, but I think a biography would have been too much. So I think it was nice to get these details about Washington, but to get him in this context where you're kind of jumping around. It doesn't feel laborious.
Well, the other thing to me about that was useful in including Washington is this is, in a sense, a book about the American Revolution. But when you're off with Venture Smith or you're with the corn planter, you might forget that it's so far removed from that story as we know it. But whenever you're with Washington, you know where you are within our normal sort of framework of the period. So it's helpful in that sense. But I'll tell you that my original idea, and this gives you an idea of how long ago I had this notion for this book. My original thought for a founding father was Hamilton, because I thought at the time, Hamilton doesn't get enough attention, which, you know, that was a while ago.
Now, let's talk about Hamilton. How would you say you characterized him?
Hamilton?
Yeah.
Well, I'm mostly looking at Hamilton through the eyes of Yeats.
Yeah.
Yeats is this feisty anti-elitist, and they're both New Yorkers, and I think it's fair to say they hated each other. And they were both from, you know, humble beginnings. And I think Yeats, you know, sneered at the fact that Hamilton had all these pretensions, and he marries into the Schuyler family, and, you know, and right in the middle of, you know, he comes for his wedding right into Albany, into Yeats's turf, you know, and you know, that carries right through to the Constitutional Convention and right up to Hamilton kind of having a kind of classic political arm twisting session with Yeats to try to get him to come on board. So, you know, the way I'm looking at Hamilton in the book is through, you know, when I'm with any of these six, even Germain, who's maybe the hardest to do, you want to kind of see it, the world, from their perspective. You know, you want to be on their side.
Since you mentioned Germain, if Germain were a fictional character, and so let's say someone were a novelist writing this character, his name change, what would that signify?
Well, he was born Sackville, George Sackville, and just to for those who aren't familiar, he grew up on an estate called Knoll, K-N-O-L-E, and
a calendar house,
and this grand house, and a family friend who lived there was a Lady Betty Germain, who was very wealthy. Her husband had died, and she had no children. And so when she died, she put in her will that he would get, that young George would get her money if he took over the Germain name. Yeah. So he changed his name right in the middle of his very public career. He changes his name.
How uncommon was that?
I don't know. People did that because of titles.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
People changed. At that level of society, people did that. But it was said, you know, he had... we didn't talk about his disgrace in battle, which was, I mean, he was for a while the most hated man in England. And his opponents, of whom there were many, because he was so aggressive and outspoken, never let him forget the disgrace at Minden, and they would call him the Coward of Minden. And when he changed his name, they basically said, "Oh, you know, you may be able to change your name, but we're not going to forget who you really are."
So that kind of answers
thing.
My question.
Yeah. I mean, it was kind of like something that you might do if you were creating fiction. I guess
exactly.
At that point, right?
Yeah. Let's talk about this these big ideas that hold this all together. Obviously, freedom being the biggest and the most obvious. Now, we all know the difficulties with using a word like freedom. Yeah. I mean, it could mean anything, really. Right. I mean, at times it could mean, it could simply mean, in many cases, I think it just means dignity and self-respect. Mm-hmm. And honor comes up often, mm-hmm. which is similar to freedom. So how did you deal with a word that was so ambiguous, but certainly is a real thing? I mean, people believe in this.
It's a real thing, but it's not one real thing is the problem.
Yeah.
First of all, when I had this idea and then I slowly went through and assembled these people and then convinced myself that this could work and it's worth going out on this limb to try to write this, I had very clearly in mind the idea that there's so many zillions of books written about the American Revolution and they all presume to tell you what it means. Yeah. I, in this book, am not going to tell you what it means. All I'm going to do is write these lies.
That was always your plan?
My plan was just write these stories and make them one story and don't make the book mean anything. Then I got about 150 pages into it and I had my moment of crisis because I just felt strange about the book.
Well,
and
when we first met, I asked you about, I remember saying, I'm sorry to
no, go ahead.
I remember thinking like, oh, you really write these books or you get them out and you're like, well, you know, it takes a lot of work to do this.
Yeah.
And you said that in all these books, you have that moment of crisis.
Yeah. There's always a crisis. Yeah. And with this one, it was stop. And I reread what I had probably for a couple of months. And then it slowly occurred to me, you know, I'm trying to write a book that's not about anything. And a book has to be about something. And then once that occurred to me, you'd think I would realize that by now. But once it occurred to me, then I realized, well, it is about something. I've just been pushing it back because I didn't want to, you know, take on that mantle of something. And I realized that what it is about is freedom. But looking, as I said before, coming out of my Dutch background, so to speak, in the 1600s, and the world of Descartes and Spinoza and the Dutch Enlightenment and this new focus on the human mind and human reason and that knowledge is based on that rather than on received wisdom from the Bible. And that, along with that, came a new sense of valuing individuals and a new commitment to freedom, to ideas like that. And so coming from that perspective, in a way, I came at the American Revolution from the other side. You know, I was more comfortable from the 1600s moving forward than I was looking back. And when I did that, I saw that, you know, freedom is actually a much broader thing in the 1770s than we often think of it. And then I saw all these people as kind of acting out different kinds of freedom within that larger wave. And then I thought, okay, I can play with that. I can make little connections, but not overly stress them so that you're overburdening the word. That was the idea.
Okay. Now I think the most complicated or I don't know if I want to say riskiest use is for the Iroquois, using freedom to talk about what they value.
Uh-huh.
This is a completely alien concept to them in this kind of Enlightenment context. So at one point you say Washington was built around, quote, crisp notions like property rights and written contracts. Theirs, the Iroquois, was something entirely other. In comparison, even slaves had a more graspably transactional definition of what it meant to be free. Iroquois freedom was too free. It shaded to waywardness. And then you ask if these two notions of freedom can be reconciled. And another point you said that Iroquois freedom was basic to the Iroquois.
Yeah. I tried to, just what you just read, I tried to toss this out there, this notion, without attempting to put it together neatly. That was suggested to me by Michael Galvin, who is the curator at the Ganondagan Seneca Museum, which is just south of Rochester, which is a great place to visit. And he helped me a lot in at least trying to come to some understanding of the Iroquois worldview and this notion, you know, their notion of things like freedom. So I thought it was worth trying to include it or suggesting it in this context, since I'm applying or suggesting freedom as something that each of the characters is kind of caught up in or addressing. As you said, I think that same passage, I ended up saying something like, he's not a philosopher. He didn't know, as a way to kind of step back from it. Like I'm not going to try to tie that too neatly.
I assume going in, you had the strongest preconceived idea of anyone of Washington.
Yeah.
Is that correct? How did that change?
Washington is kind of famously enigmatic to Americans. And I think for one thing, it's so wonderful to do this now that all of his writings are immediately available to me, you know, so I could just spend months swimming in his, you know, brain, his thought processes. One reason I wanted to start these from birth and march through their childhoods is that you then can yourself and help the reader to see where they're coming from and what formed them. And I actually, maybe it's kind of hubris, but I kind of felt that I got him. Like I understood this, the death of his father and how he was, had up to that point had these expectations of, you know, being educated in England, getting a proper education, becoming a proper Virginia planter, and then a lot of that is taken away from him. And then he, you know, as a teenager, makes these decisions to create the outward trappings of being part of the gentry, and then has the luck to get kind of adopted by the Fairfax family, and goes on from there. But you can see this expectation that will never go away, and with that is this ambition, and then at the same time, there's a certain which is not original with me to say that he had this kind of inferiority complex when he was in these rooms full of great men like John Jay and Thomas Jefferson, that he didn't have the education, he didn't study law, he didn't speak French, and so all of that together kind of goes to make this kind of, I can see that making this, I don't know, psychological baggage that works against him, but also propels him forward.
What were your sources for Germain?
The sources for Germain?
Yeah.
University of Michigan, the Clements Library. His papers are there. The Clements Library has the biggest collection of Revolutionary War manuscript material. Thousands of pages of material there. A lot of it is available online. Documentary, the artifacts of the life of Lord North. I mean, the other men around him.
He tied it together.
Tying all that together. Yeah. The parliamentary debates, his debate when he's up. And a lot of it, of course, is just public record when his court-martial trial. What you look for then, because you want to get the personal, is you look for the little things, like when he's in the midst of all this terrible, the world is coming down on him, and there's some mention of like playing chess with his daughter or something, and you just latch onto that, like, okay, that's a moment where we get a little light onto something else, some distraction, the other parts of his world. And the same with others, like Yeats wrote voluminously, but as was common at that time, not much of it is personal, but you look for ways in. And one was, for me with Yeats, was the records of the Dutch Reformed Church in Albany, and how I think there is a period of about 6 years when he and his wife bury four children, four newborns. And then in the middle of that is the birth of his daughter, the one who survives. So while he's dealing with all of these calamities, you add that to it, this very this very personal thing where they're trying and having all these deaths of small children, it gives you a little bit more of a sense of what the rounded person was.
Okay. And I think that kind of leads us in another question I had about your writing in general. Let's call it, where did I put it here? Let's call it poetic license.
Okay.
Okay. Like, for example, Sackville sat silently through it all. At last he rose in a strong voice, but one tremored with mm-hmm. anger. Mm-hmm. That's your imagination.
No, that's from the records. I mean, well, really? Tremored, I mean,
that's what I mean. And I think,
but people covered those debates pretty, intently, you know, and they okay. made fun of him a lot.
No, because I think that I know that Lynn Cheney mentioned this in the review about you saying that Washington felt like a country bumpkin.
Yeah.
And she took issue with that.
Yeah. And I think that, you know, I haven't gone back to look up, but I know that that was based on, you know, either his writings or writings of people who were referring to him.
Which is kind of an issue with not having, because I know that sometimes like not having copious footnotes could seem mm-hmm. freeing. But in a way, it's not, because sometimes it doesn't seem like you could cite exactly what you're saying.
Footnotes is the question of footnotes is you can over footnote. You can footnote every single. You can footnote. You can add three footnotes to a single sentence with great legitimacy, and you can overburden your document. And so every time I'm going through another draft of a chapter, I'm, you know, should I footnote that? Should I take out that footnote? You know,
you're generally footnoting quotes, right? Is that most of your footnotes?
I try to, I'm footnoting quotes, but I'm also footnoting things that I think someone's going to say, is that true or is that right? Or where did that come from? I mean, that's basically what I'm trying to do. But there are a lot of things that are, you know, the use of a particular, I forget what you just said, the verb.
His voice tremored?
Like that. Like, okay, I could have footnoted that, but I don't know, you know, then you think I don't have to footnote.
Well, I don't think you do either.
That's what you get to, because then you get, maybe a reviewer is going to say, how do you know that?
Exactly.
So,
but I think it's interesting to me, because I think that, you know, every statement can be qualified.
Yeah.
We don't really know what happened. So you could spend the whole book saying he may have done this.
Right.
He may
and
have
you
done
do a
that.
Lot of that when you're writing this. Yeah. You do a lot of using the language to say, you know, things to use to hedge your bets a little bit.
Yeah. The way I take such things is you immersed yourself in this character, kind of got into his personality, and then gave your interpretation of how.
It's an interpretation,
kind of,
but it's an interpretation based on what he said what other people said about him. But you know, with a case like that, you know, a tremor in his voice, where did that come from? I mean, there is interpretation. Yeah,
oh,
there's
certainly
a difference between interpretation and license, I think.
You think so?
Yeah, I think you can interpret. You're taking 10 pages of material and you're turning it into a sentence or a three sentence description or something. So that is interpretation. I don't know, but I don't think it's license.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't think
it's distilling.
I didn't think of license as any kind of pejorative sense.
Okay,
I was
well,
just
that's
thinking.
That's the way I'm thinking.
Oh, really?
Of it. Yeah.
Okay. I was just thinking like kind of using your authority.
That's exactly it.
Yeah,
authority, because this is what I would say to about the process of doing history. The reader is coming to you saying, "I'm not going to read those 900 books. Yeah. You've read those, and you went to all these libraries and things. Now put it together and process it through your consciousness for me."
Yeah.
I mean, that's your job.
Yeah.
And people can choose totally legitimately based on their personality or whatever else to do it one way or another, but I think that's your job.
Yeah.
Interpretation. Interpretation is the work of history. And I think, you know, I just did a, some guy has a website and he has people who have new books out. I think it's called 10questions.com. Okay. So he asked you 10 questions and I, you know, not in this kind of format, but in writing. And so then I gave him my responses. And one of his questions was, what do you think of the role of storytelling in history? And I said, I think history is storytelling. That's where we get meaning. And you can tell stories with footnotes, and so that people can check on you and things like that. But that's basically the essence of it.
We're dealing with with. Often detailed records, but even detailed records leave an extraordinary amount to the
imagination.
History,
and I think people who don't, who've never really done it, maybe don't appreciate the extent to which history is just stuff.
Certainly, yeah.
It's just, and you know this very well, but I mean, it's just dots. And your job is to connect the dots, and that's the interpretation, connecting the dots.
And I think this idea that, you know, imagination, I think if historians would have used the word imagination 50 years ago, people would have been disgusted. Mm-hmm. But I don't think that's really true today. I think about my advisor thinking about how this historian imagines the past. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what it is. I mean, mm-hmm. you're using evidence, but you're filling in the blanks.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's necessary. And I respect historians who try not to do that or take a kind of quantitative approach or something, but they're doing something that's so far different. They're trying to remove the storytelling component of it. And so they're obviously then creating it for a very different audience and for a very different purpose.
And they're often, as far as there might be a criticism of trying too hard to tell a story, mm-hmm. but then they're trying too hard to make an argument.
Well, I don't know about too hard. It's just for a different purpose and a different readership.
Yeah. Okay. So talk a little more broadly about your, although we've already really gotten into that, your approach to writing. Now, you taught a class this semester at Baruch College, mm-hmm. right? How did that go?
It was great. I made it. My next book is about my grandfather and his world in my hometown in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, in mostly kind of in the 50s. And so I decided to make the class writing about family, because it was where my head was. And it was also, it's something that I figure students, college students, that they are not expert in many things, but they're expert in their families or interested in their families. And so it was a lot, I think it worked well in the sense that a lot of people applied for it. And I think it was a really good class. I think we all got a lot out of it. And I learned a lot from doing it. I told them at the end, I fear that I learned more than they did, but it was worthwhile.
Like what? What did you learn?
When I came upon this story, or as I had the story of my grandfather from the time I was a child, and as I started to explore it as a historian, as a writer, it started to get more complicated and kind of uglier, and you know. And they all early, I had them do pick a story or in their family early on at the beginning of the class, at the beginning of the semester. I asked them to come in with three possible ideas, and we all batted those around, and that was remarkable. Then they narrowed it to one that they were going to work on for the semester and write one piece, like an essay about that. And most of them then were interviewing their uncle or their mother, whoever it was, and coming to the class, and some of them would come to the class like in tears because they were realizing it wasn't the way they thought. Okay, it was some. So I realized that whole process is part of, basically part of just growing up and becoming a more mature person and seeing the world as more nuanced. And, you know, you put these little templates on, that's Uncle Charlie. But then once you get into it, no, Uncle Charlie wasn't that. He was really something else, you know.
Can you go into more detail about this next book?
It's my grandfather and his brother-in-law who kind of ran the mob in my hometown in the 40s, 50s, 60s.
You're going to be okay writing this?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, right now I'm reading the autobiography of Joseph Bonanno, who was the head of the Bonanno crime family. Okay. I mean, if he can lay it all out, you know. I think we're past the period when you can't talk about these things. Okay. But I could be wrong.
Well, we'll find out.
Yeah, I guess we'll find out. But it's really, it's a family story, and it's a story about small town America when it was like booming in its industrial heyday, you know, the 50s, and then there Johnstown was the steel mills, and they called it Little Chicago. And so it's really kind of about that world that, you know, a lot of people are really rue that it is gone.
So how different do you think your audience will be for that book than
I don't
than
know. You know, someone, others? I was just at the, giving a talk at the Princeton Battlefield Society, and someone asked me that question, and he said, I'll tell you who your central audience is going to be. It's going to be Italian Americans. And I said, maybe that's true. But I think for any book, at least in my experience, you have your core group who are the automatic people, you know, with Island at the Center of the World, Dutch Americans. But then you've got all these other people who are interested for other reasons. So it's not just one constituency, I hope.
Do you think of that reader when you're writing?
Probably not. I probably just think of what I think of myself as a reader. I think that's what I do. I just want, like, if I were reading this book, what would I, you know, what kind of book would I want it to be? And then I hope that there are a lot of me out there.
Yeah. I just came across this John Steinbeck quote about that exact thing. And then he says, forget your generalized audience. In the first place, the nameless, faceless audience will scare you to death. Right. And in the second place, unlike the theater, it doesn't exist. In writing, your audience is one single reader. I have found that sometimes it helps to pick out one person, a real person you know, or an imagined person, and write to that.
Yeah, I've done that. And I've also, when I reread, because, you know, you do like 50 or 100 drafts of a chapter or something, and to make it fresh, I will reread it in the voice of some, like I'll pick, you know, Patrick Stewart, the actor, some really resonant voice, and I'll read it as if that person in my head were reading it. And that helps it to be fresh to me.
You read it out loud?
No. Oh, okay. I mean, I'm reading it, and in my head, I'm hearing Patrick Stewart or Robert De Niro or whoever.
I changed the font. It.
That too. Yeah. You play with that too. Any trick you can do.
Yeah. How great would it be? Or maybe it wouldn't. Maybe it seems great and it wouldn't be, but to be able to get outside yourself and read it.
Yeah.
Because it's hard to be clear when you know what you're trying to say.
Right. You want to just see it fresh and see the flaws or see with the confusion or where you're being misleading or whatever.
Okay. I have one last question for you. And you wrote in Revolution Song, when Washington turned 50, quote, he was able to ponder one of the lessons of experience, that dreams, when achieved, irretrievably differ from youthful imaginings, unquote. So, Mr. Shorto, you are...
you're turning that on me?
I'm turning that on you. So that's one of the interesting things about reading this book, mm-hmm. is that I know you. Mm-hmm. And so I thought about you writing it.
Uh-huh.
And when I read that, I was like, Russell is similar age.
Oh, you think I was, okay.
Of course. You must have had something in your mind about that. So tell us. Well, first, you've made a career writing, which is, much like playing music, is not very common, right?
Yeah, I guess. It's not as you expect. And in some ways, I would have thought, if you're asking me to look back at myself when I was 20 or something, I would have thought that if you're able to make a career as a writer, then you must be some, you know, hot shot, like rock star or something. Yeah. And it's not. It's very mundane for the most part. You're sitting in a room by yourself and, you know, once in a while you get to go out and, you know, talk about what you do. And on the other hand, it's at least the kind of writing I do. What I never could have imagined is how much it plugs you into different currents in life and in the world, whether it's, you know, at universities or people involved in public history or people involved in, you know, for example, since I've written a good bit about the Dutch and Dutch history, then suddenly water management and climate change. I mean, all that is kind of, you know, and I'm kind of swimming, so to speak, in those streams as well. Previous editor of mine said it's always amazed him how when you publish a book, you just sit back and watch all the different places it goes and when you've published 6 books, they're kind of going all different directions, the paths are crossing, and it's a, you know, I couldn't have imagined that.
How do you look back at your old books?
As, I guess, you know, earlier versions of yourself, partly. Some I like better than others. Sure. I think the one that I, you know, when people say, which one do you like best? I kind of say I like Descartes' Bones best, but it's the least successful of them. But it's probably the one that I, to your earlier question, that I really wrote for myself as the reader. Like if I were standing at a bookstore at the table and I saw a book called Descartes' Bones, I would pick it up and I would go to the counter and I'd buy it. But I don't think a whole lot of people feel that way.
Well, it was interesting. As I was reading, and I took a note somewhere in my messy notes. Mm-hmm. It was interesting. It was a page or two where I could see this was you were going back to the well of things that you had done before. You were talking about Spinoza. You were talking about Descartes, and you could see how this you had built this knowledge with your past books, and you were bringing it back.
Well, I think that you, as a writer, you normally tend to, I mean, some people stay strictly within, whether it's New Netherland or the American Revolution or whatever, stick strictly within those boundaries. But I think even if you don't, what you're doing is connected. It's the same brain, it's the same consciousness, and you have the same interests, and they bubble up in one way or another in whatever the project is. Okay. And they connect to each other in some way, you know, and it takes a while to look back and say, oh, I see now how that connected. But maybe at the time you didn't think this will flow naturally from this other thing I did.
Okay, Russell, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.